Welcome, everyone, to episode 446 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we have a great episode for you. We are officially in off-season mode. The draft is less than a week away, free agency soon thereafter, so we will be talking, kind of taking a step back and talking big picture NBA stuff with a special guest. Before we get to that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is someone who did not have to clean a dirty diaper 5 minutes ago, Morten Jensen. How is life without a four-month-old?
Well, I still have a two-year-old who needs diaper changes, so and it wasn't five minutes ago, an hour ago or so. So I'm in the same boat. I love how inexperienced you are with this. Basically, just like everything's new. Like, oh, yeah. he crapped himself. Look, this is all very joyous. Like, you'll get tired of it pretty soon.
Oh no, I'm very 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 ready for potty training already. He's going to be the first potty trained 6 month old on the planet.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, thank you. So as I mentioned, we are being joined by a special guest. It is Bleacher Report's Jake Fisher, the author of Built to Lose, a great book. It's subtitled How the NBA's Tanking Error Changed the League Forever. So, Jake, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, guys. Thank you so much for having me. This is going to be a good time.
Of course, yeah. So before we get into the book, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter, where they can buy the book, and any other work you'd like to promote?
Yeah, the book is available anywhere books are sold, Amazon, bookshop.org, my publisher Triumph, Barnes & Noble's been doing a great job putting it out on the shelves. So anywhere you guys buy it would be greatly appreciated. Prefer the print copy, and you know, if you can rate it and review it, if you do give a purchase, that'd be greatly appreciated. And you know, it's got, like, I talked to over 300 people for that, players, agents, coaches, executives, to bring. I think there's new info on every single page. You guys read it, so you can back me up on that. Behind the scenes stories, you know, interpersonal infighting, all that type of stuff. It's just, I really tried to peel back the curtain on things that pop up when, you know, you set out to be a rebuild or to team build any type of structure, right? There's always unforeseen variables that come into play and drama behind the scenes. And I really tried to show how this NBA world really does operate. You know, we see the stuff on the surface, and there's only so much we can report and talk about. But that's that, you know, when it happens 5-10 years ago in the past, you can kind of take a knife to it and really uncover what really happened beneath the surface.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And I look forward to in 10 years you're doing a sequel for the OKC rebuild.
We'll get there.
Yeah, we'll definitely get there.
I was going to say, I feel like everyone, now that Danny Ainge is gone, he was like the last primary figure in the book. I think everyone else, all of the other executives have since been fired. So maybe their non-disclosure agreements have relapsed and now they're ready to talk finally.
Yeah, it's the NDA with that Philly team too was a thing. And Ryan McDonough, you know, not to put him on blast, he's out doing media now and stuff like that, being that his NDA with Phoenix expired as well. So NDAs are a real thing. They're definitely a real thing.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask, before we get into some of the nitty-gritty of the book, like, what motivated you to go write this?
Yeah, it's a long answer, but the short story is, you know, I started my career really covering that 2013 draft when Sam took over and Ryan McDonough took over in Phoenix. That wasn't long after Rob Hennigan was running things in Orlando and David Griffin was coming to power in Cleveland and the Kings hired Pete D'Alessandro. There was definitely, you guys probably remember as well as anybody, there was definitely a huge tug and pull in the league between the analytics guys coming to power and the quote-unquote basketball PhD people. And, you know, I think that was a big inflection point in the league. And those guys coming to power really emphasized tanking and team building altogether. And, you know, being from Philly originally, I was in school in Boston at the time. You know, I started covering that draft when I was interning at Slam. I was in the back corner of the magazine's office, you know, right by Madison Square Park. in Manhattan, and you know, there's not much for me to do. They kind of said, like, make this internship what you want it to be, and I started calling up agents, and you know, ended up talking to a lot of players who were second round pick, you know, late first round prospects in that class, and started building from there. And when I went to Boston back for school, I was going to TD Garden, and the Celtics were tanking too, right? Like you mentioned, Danny Ainge, they traded KG and Paul Pierce to Brooklyn the same night that Sam Hinkie traded Drew Holiday to New Orleans. So I felt like I was kind of in that eye of that tanking hurricane, if you will. Like whenever Philly came to Boston, I was still writing for SB Nation, Liberty Ballers at the time, and you know, it just felt like those two teams were on a collision course, like they did end up being in the playoffs for a couple of years, right? So just the book ended up seeming to be a way to kind of put a cap on the first 8 years of my career and all the reporting and conversations that I did have, because living in Boston and being from Philly, just it was impossible to escape the tanking conversation during those years.
Yeah. And I feel like it still comes up. We just saw someone just shared with me a Marcus Hayes column from today about, you know, how the Sixers screwed up because they chose Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid over Giannis and Drew Holiday. So the tanking and the Sixers process debates will never die. That's for sure.
Agreed.
As you were doing the reporting for this book, which really, as you said, starts kind of with the 2013 draft and really covers in detail through 2014, 2015. What were some of your top takeaways?
I think the biggest takeaway, like 1,000-foot view, is that the NBA is a wild, wild business and an ecosystem and a marketplace where you've got hundreds of people involved, the players, agents, coaches, executives I mentioned, I interviewed, like all those dudes and women. They got their own independent, individual agendas. They're all trying to advance themselves while also working in this team environment, this team sport that, you know, really require. I mean, basketball at its purity, right, is about sharing the ball and, you know, it's an egalitarian thing, and that's not what the NBA is. It's everyone from video coordinators who are locked in that back dungeon cutting film trying to, you know, you use their opportunities to create better chances for them to move up, and players trying to get more minutes to get their next contract, and head coaches trying to survive, and executives doing whatever they can to keep convincing ownership that they're the one to run this team. And I think when you set out to rebuild, or you set out to build a team in any structure, like I was talking about a little bit earlier, there's so many things involved that, you know, it's not so simple as just, we're going to trade our best players, we're going to tank, we're going to draft this guy, and then we're going to add a couple complimentary pieces, and we're going to be in the playoffs. Like, what the Hawks did this year is, like, the tried and true formula that everyone's trying to do, but it's so rare to do that. I mean, the flip side of that, you know, Trey always gets compared to Luka, right, being their draft night trade, and the Mavericks just haven't been able to get out of the first round. And they're trying to, they obviously want to, but it's a lot easier said than done, so I think, you know, all that stuff, like I said, like just finding out the little details behind the scenes on how these things get derailed off course and how a plan gets, you know, sidetracked, you know, those types of anecdotes, I think are all in there, and they show why these little incidences end up kind of making, you know, $2 billion organizations about face and pivot and go in a different direction.
Yeah, I liked, you know, obviously, like, Sam Hinkie and the process were the ones that got the most attention during this era for what they were doing. But I liked how you weaved in a lot of these other organizations that were also, like, do you call it tanking or rebuilding? Where is the line there? But, you know, like the Lakers are heavily featured, the Magic, the Timberwolves for a while, Phoenix, a lot of good details about Phoenix, especially the Sacramento Kings, who are still kind of mired in this mediocrity, rebuilding, tanking, whatever you want to call it. And I do like especially how, as you said, you know, you kind of see where these battle lines are drawn. Like the Kings stuff, you know, when they fired Mike Malone and bring in George Karl, on the surface that seemed weird. And like there were details at the time I remember being reported, like Boogie and Karl were clashing, but you really get some things that I had never seen before about just how much those guys were like oil and water together, and then what that meant for Pete D'Alessandro, the general manager at the time, and, you know, like Vlade Divac coming on. it's just wild how all of these organizations had some like similar, like parallel lines almost, like what happened with Sacramento and Philly with like this behind the scenes, you know, power struggle.
Yeah, and I think that there's no secret that, you know, the teams that end up being mired in the outside the postseason looking in year after year after year, I think it starts at the top. I think that's partially why Phoenix missed the playoffs for so long. Robert Sarver isn't exactly, you know, considered to be the most level-headed, pragmatic, you know, realistic thinker. He's someone who, you know, fell in love with Jeff Hornacek and made him their head coach, and you know, then started falling for Earl Watson pretty quickly, and Earl Watson became the guy, and then James Jones, you know, seemed to be someone who got in really close to Robert Sarver, and now, you know, he's obviously running the show there. And, you know, Vlade Divac, this whole thing in Sacramento is very similar. Like, Vivek brings in Michael Malone to be their head coach before he hires Pete D'Alessandro to be the general manager. And then already, right from the jump, started speculation then publicly and around the league that, you know, Pete would soon fire Malone, because every GM wants to hire their own head coach. And then before Pete even really has an opportunity to do that, they bring in Vlade Divac. So, you know, and you know, the wheel just keeps on spinning, where they brought in Joe Dumars and ultimately ends up pushing out Vlade. And, you know, they hired Monte McNair to be their next general manager today, who, you know, by all accounts is a really smart, intelligent, forward-thinking, analytics-driven guy. But, you know, there's also a lot of talk around the league that Mike Forte, this guy that's now, you know, been brought to the public eye as this executive search, you know, person. He was very strong about bringing on Wes Wilcox to be Monty McNair's assistant GM, and it doesn't sound like that was really something that was welcomed by other candidates who were in the mix for that GM job, you know. So that type of stuff is still going on. And you see, you know, to bring it back to Philly, they bring on Daryl Morey. I was saying it for years that it's obvious Elton Brand did not have the president title. They were leaving that position open to bring in somebody potentially over him. And the ownership had ideas on Daryl dating back to when they let go of Brian in the first place. And, you know, the titles mean stuff. And, you know, obviously bringing on Daryl Morey, one of the more aggressive general managers in league history, presidents, whatever you want to call it, you know, that's going to change some things there. And now we're seeing all the Ben Simmons stuff. I think that would have happened even regardless of his postseason struggles. So just changing direction and bringing on different voices and all that type of stuff, you know, it happens across the board. But when you're mired outside of the playoff picture, you know, that stuff tends to pop up and rear its ugly head and have their effects, I think, more drastically than everywhere else. Because if you don't have the talent to get you there, it's so much harder to get there when you have 17 different cooks in your kitchen, right?
Right.
So one of the things that I think puts that into contrast very, very well is your snippet about the San Antonio Spurs when they're recruiting LaMarcus Aldridge. Hmm. I mean, there's just no drama. It's them just chit-chatting. There's no, like you put it in the book, they didn't have some detailed presentation. It was just them in casual clothing sitting down and talking to LaMarcus. And at the end of the day, that was exactly what LaMarcus wanted, and he ended up signing there. I think that little snippet was just such a fun little thing to read, because it just put everything else in such a wild contrast. That's where I really opened my eyes going, wow, the NBA can really be a complete shit show, and everything's bad.
I mean, I was talking to someone this morning about it. The majority of teams are a shit show. Like, there's conflicting, I don't want to keep using the word agendas. That sounds so conniving, but there's this conflicting interest. And I mean, look what happened to Utah, right? They're the best team in the league, and Dwayne Wade comes in as a minority owner. And by all accounts, he had a huge factor in Dennis Lindsay exiting stage left. And, you know, Detroit has a number one pick right now. There's all this talk around the league about, you know, who's really in charge there. Is it Troy Weaver? Is it Arne Tellem? And you just go down the list in Houston with Rafael Stone. Like, Patrick Fertitta, Tillman's son, is supposed to be someone who has a lot of influence there. And, you know, the Sixers, over the years, their ownership group has had different meddling, you know, capacities, let's say, in their draft decisions and their trade decisions. So it just, I mean, I just mentioned three, like, off the top of my head, like that. Like, I could keep going, but I don't want to keep, you know, there's only so many people I want to anger at once, you know? So it is remarkable, but I think it goes back to the LaMarcus point. You know, these people are all just people, and everyone's got their sentimentalities and their interests and, you know, their personalities, and, like, that's what worked for LaMarcus. But there are other people who want to get a glitzy, starry, you know, I mean, the pitch that the Lakers made to Carmelo in 2014, I think, really worked. I think he was super down to go to the Lakers, but he wasn't going there by himself, and the Lakers, unfortunately, shot themselves in the foot, giving Kobe that big, fat contract extension, you know, all those many months before, and they limited their cap flexibility. You know, maybe they could have signed LeBron and Carmelo all the way back in 2014, but it didn't work out. So I think that just – but that goes to show, like, every star who these teams are tanking for, who these teams are clearing cap space for, they're their own different breed. They're their own different dude. And I think, you know, that's also why building a successful team in the league is so treacherous and so, you know, just difficult, being that the one ingredient you can never really truly measure is just the human element to things. And I think that gets so overlooked sometimes by the public, is that this is just a business with and the 30 different offices and workplaces that just happen to be covered, you know, to the nth degree, and they make millions and billions of dollars.
And now you mentioned personality. I mean, that was very apparent to me also when it came to Evan Turner, for example. Like, just the way that he was wired, you know, he made I had a legitimate, literal laughing my ass off moment when I read that part where he was basically waving at Sam Hinkie, going, "Hi, Sam, we're the Philadelphia 76ers," because Sam just didn't interact with them a whole bunch.
Yeah.
That was glorious. And I think that little snippet just showed so much in terms of, when you have an hands-off approach, what kind of effect that can have on the team that you're managing, your individual players. Like, maybe half that group wouldn't really have looked at it one way or the other because they were used to that sort of thing. But Evan Turner specifically was like, "Nope, that's not the way I operate. I want the human element. That's something I like as a player." So I think that it's such an interesting component because, like you say, you have to make sure all these personalities mesh. You have to make sure everything kind of aligns and adds up. And having a GM who isn't the strongest communicator, especially with players and agents, might have played a significant part in his downfall.
For sure. I think Evan Turner is one of the unsung heroes of the book. He's just a delightful character, and he pops up again, obviously, because he goes to Boston. And there's so many great scenes where he's finding Brad Stevens during that 13-14 Sixers year. You know, in the hallway, in between the locker rooms, you know, because they had some relationship back to Team USA stuff, and he's going up to Brad and saying, you know, "Please trade for me," you know, that type of stuff is just hilarious. And then when he goes to Indiana, he falls out of favor, right? Like, when he gets traded there, there's all this talk, you know, now the Pacers are going to be, they're the real super team, they're going to take down Miami, and Evan's not even playing. You know, he's getting DMPs in that series in the conference finals, and he goes into free agency, like, depressed and really having an identity crisis. Like, does he even want to play basketball anymore? But then he becomes this veteran leader with this know-how, this kind of, you know, old sage at, like, the age of 26 in Boston with all these young guys. And so I just think, you know, that's why Sam Hinkie was such an interesting figure and someone I really kind of – I mean, I definitely wanted to humanize him a lot in the book, and I think I accomplished that. That's been a lot of feedback I've gotten, because I do think he's a really nice person. I think he can be charming and funny and clever in person and in conversation, not just in, you know, cap sheets and all that type of stuff. But I think he'll admit that a lot of his mistakes that he made were definitely interpersonal, and, you know, those relationships that he thought maybe he would have benefited by neglecting them to be able to do a better job, you know, and also, you know, they're relating to the media and speaking publicly. I think, yeah, I do think all that was clear as a real, you know, main ingredient as to why he is no longer working in basketball. I think he probably could still be if he wanted to, but I think the rug got pulled out for him pretty aggressively, right, with that ownership group. And I think it's just clear around the NBA, you know, you're only in power as an executive as long as your ownership believes in you. and with the media narratives at play and other people in the league trying to get your job and spreading, you know, information that is definitely true a lot of the time, but they're trying to keep that swirl moving so that, like, there's all this talk now about, you know, Utah continuing to, you know, who they're looking at to bring in on, you know, to run the show after Lindsay goes out. You know, I think a lot of that information keeps being propped up by people in the league who want that job to be open, you know. But I think with Sam, he recognizes those shortcomings, and I think even still, you know, he'd rather be running, you know, a venture capital fund. And we see him on Twitter now, always pumping up these small little tech startups. Like, those are companies that he's got a handle on, or a hand in, or money in, that he's, you know, supporting and trying to boost and all that type of stuff. So I think that's kind of where he's going to be for, maybe that's a question you guys were going to ask later down the road, but I think that kind of sums up my Sam Hinkie thoughts for you.
Yeah, I was planning to ask about him, because I think, especially as a Philly guy, and Yaron Weitzman had the book out a couple months ago that we talked to him about, I think you two guys have done the best job of anyone of being as, like, even-keeled and objective about Hinkie in particular, but, like, just the process era Sixers. Like, it's not, this guy was brilliant, this is a master plan, it was guaranteed to work, and then you're not, you know, every Philadelphia columnist above the age of 40 where it's like, this guy is a fraud, he's, you know, he should refund season ticket holders. Like, you know, you guys both acknowledge this made sense conceptually, but here's where he fell short. And I thought especially it came through with your interviews with, you know, some of the agents, and yeah, how his refusal to spend salary cap space ended up hurting him specifically in that 2015 draft with Porzingis, where Andy Miller, like, would not let Porzingis work out for the Sixers, wouldn't give them their medical information. So, you know, in retrospect, do you think, not only for the Sixers and Sam, but in general, like, as the Sixers were going through the process years, so many people were calling it, you know, like, a scourge and, like, to the game of basketball, like, saying it's an affront, they're affronting the basketball gods. What's your take on that, having now, you know, dove into this era as deeply as you did?
Yeah, I do think Sam is a genius, and I think he is one of the smartest people I've ever interacted with. But like you said, I don't think the strategy he did was so revelatory. I think what he did was he took the rules and played them to the nth degree, being that the lottery system at the time, and even still to this day, even though they, you know, the book is called The Tanking Era Changed the League Forever, right? That's the subhead. And I think, obviously, the lottery reform is a clear, you know, result. And I think the play-in tournament is also a big factor in instituting that, was to try to dissuade teams from losing games at the end of the season and try to give them an even greater opportunity to make the playoffs. But also, I think, streamline the conversation about team building and about asset collection and valuation and stuff that we're having right now. I think that was a major result of this as well. I think it's made being a GM that much harder, because the public perception and the public opinion about winning the trade and all that type of stuff, you know, it's the pressure to be a successful GM is greater now more than ever. I think that was part of this strategy and you know, talking so openly about that type of these types of moves and these types of maneuvering overall. Like, I think that is also directly related back to him. But I think where he did stand out was, you know, what OKC is doing right now, I think, is very similar. But he did it in a major market that has massive expectations, not just you know, to be a part of, you know, just the fabric of the league, but also in the revenue sharing situation that we're in right now. I think, you know, that's also was a huge factor, being that Philly is the fourth, fifth, whatever you want to call it, biggest media market in the country, and that team is supposed to be feeding into the revenue stream every single year. And being that they weren't, being that they were, you know, not even being, they weren't apologetic about it either. Like, Sam Presti I went to his Zoom press conference at the end of the year a couple weeks back, and he opened up on some 30-minute monologue about where they are as a franchise and how, you know, luck is unfortunately a big part of their strategy, but being in their market, you know, and trying to build a winner that Oklahoma City is proud of, you know, this is their best route to do so. And I don't, and obviously Sam was transparent in what they were trying to do. But he definitely had a bit of a, well, I don't have to tell you my strategy. You can just see it based off of my moves type of mentality to it. And I think that boldness and audacity to do it without really having to explain it or apologize for it, if you will, I think that is what really made this such a hot button issue. And the fact that they were the number one storyline in the league for the longest time. I mean, back in those SB Nation days when I was at Liberty Ballers, we had access to see the stat dashboard across all 30 blogs in the NBA. And Liberty Ballers was pretty routinely number one, number two, number three, even though the team was the worst or second or third worst team in the league. And that 15-16 Sixers team with, you know, Jaleel getting in fights in Boston and their potential, you know, longest losing streak ever, potentially being the worst team of all time, that was literally stealing headlines from the Warriors, who literally were the best team of all time. And I think that was why it became such a thing. It was such a news item that the league office was upset about, that rival owners were complaining about low ticket sales when that team came into their market, a team that was supposed to be a team that, this was the teams over the league history that had Dr. J and Allen Iverson and, you know, the third most winningest franchise in league history. They love to pump up their chest and use that as their PR slogan, you know. So I think that was, all those factors together is why it really was such a, you know, considered to be a black eye on the league for a long time by those people.
Yeah, I think you and I both know, as Philly guys, there were just always two factions of, like, it was the younger, like, people our age and younger had just totally bought in to the Sam Hinkie. We're drinking the Sam Hinkie Kool-Aid, and it's like our parents' generation just did not get it at all. Because you're right, he never, like, went out and said, this is what we're going to do. He's just like, you know, he just did it. And if you follow, you know, if you pay attention and you're like following it closely, you're like, oh, this makes total sense. But if you're just, if you're casually like tuning in every once in a while, or you're just tuning into SportsCenter and you're seeing, oh, the Sixers are the worst team ever in the history of basketball, then yeah, it could be embarrassing for the franchise. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up OKC in particular, because I wanted to pivot into them, and you brought up the lottery reform and play-in tournament too, because, you know, obviously the league in recent years has implemented rules, if not to completely eliminate tanking, at least dissuade teams from doing what Sam Hinkie and the Sixers did, but, you know, again, some of these other teams as well. Do you think it's actually going to work, or do you think there's just nothing the league can do given how the draft works, where, you know, even though, like, if you finish with the worst record, even now, you're guaranteed a top five pick.
Yeah.
And, you know, given the incentive of, you get these guys on a rookie contract, restricted free agency, you know, you have most likely at least 7 to 9 years locked up with these guys. Like, is there anything else the league can do to prevent this, or is it just, you know, this strategy is always going to make sense to some extent?
Yeah, the short answer is no. I don't think that they've done anything. I mean, look at what happened this year. This 2021 class is ironically considered to be the best class since 2014, which was, you know, the best class since 2003, which is partially why all these execs were tanking for that class. I mean, there was so much hype that if you got one of Wiggins, Parker, Embiid, Julius Randle, Marcus Smart, Aaron Gordon, you were going to have a piece that was going to take you into the postseason for a decade. And obviously it didn't work out for a lot of those guys, and it might not work out for some of these guys in 2021, but when there's a class, you know, hyped up to be full of those guys, but also in general, the league has always, you know, dating back to the 50s with the Celtics and Bob Pettit's Hawks and whatever, championships are won by teams that have multiple All-Stars. That's typically been, you know, what's happened throughout history. Even, you know, the Dallas Mavericks in 2011, like with Dirk. They had their one guy, but they had Jason Kidd and Sean Marion and all these guys who had been, you know, major contributors at one point in time, right? And that's been brought to the forefront by these analytical guys. I mean, Daryl is obviously the biggest proponent of you just get stars in a room together, on a roster together, and you'll see what happens because talent wins out. And I think, you know, that's just kind of been where we're at now in the NBA. That with a combination of LeBron really ushering in this player empowerment era, you know, teams and superstars are kind of aligned in the fact that we want to get a bunch of you together and really make a real earnest shot at getting a ring. And, you know, if you're not the Lakers, who they're all over the book being that they were the worst team in the league from 2012 to 2017, and they still just got LeBron in free agency, right? Because they're the Lakers. Right. If you're not them, if you're not Brooklyn, you know, we'll see if New York can use this cap space they have right now to bring people of substance and of consequence, but who knows? I mean, I don't think the Knicks are getting Chris Paul. Like, I just don't. And I don't think they're getting Kyle Lowry either. Maybe they are, but, you know, we'll see. But if you're not New York, LA, or Miami, the best route to getting these guys is through the draft, because you get them, like you said, for 7 to 9 years of team control. And if you're like Phoenix, where you get Devin Booker and you get DeAndre Ayton and you show a little something, you can attract someone in free agency or via trade like Chris Paul, and you'll be able to compete then. And I think that was ultimately Philly's long-term goal. Like, I've been talking about this a lot when I've been, you know, coming on shows like yours, where I don't think their original plan was to just tank and tank and tank. There was clear evidence with Brett Brown fighting for a fourth year on his contract, and with the hires that they were making at the time, like they hired Chris Babcock and Todd Wright, who had obvious connections to Kevin Durant at Texas, who was obviously a free agent in 2016. They brought on Billy Lane from Villanova, who had obvious connections to Kyle Lowry, who was, you know, back then supposed to be someone Philly was targeting. Lloyd Pierce had a connection to LeBron. I do think 15-16 was supposed to be, you know, Joel was supposed to play that year, and they were supposed to have, you know, this a couple of draft picks come together and, you know, show a flash or two, maybe make the playoffs, maybe just compete for the 8 seed, and then they were going to make that big splurge, you know, maybe even more similar to what the Hawks did, getting Bogdan Bogdanovic and Danilo Gallinari, and, you know, here they are in the conference finals. But, you know, Embiid breaks his foot in the first, a week or two before that draft happened, and I think Joel Okafor, as I wrote in the book, a lot of the calculus behind drafting him, not just being best player available, I think was also, you know, maybe he'll clear up the fact that Embiid might just be a bust. I've been talking so long, I forget what the original question was, so I'm just going to wrap up my point, where, you know, I do think that Sam's long-term strategy, you know, has created all these ramifications, being that, you know, the league just doesn't want teams losing and losing and losing. I think the league thinks at its healthiest, where every single fan base can go into their arena that night and think we've got a good chance at winning here. But team people have just realized that there's no benefit to being in that mid-tier where Philly was before Hinkie came into play, losing in the first round. Look at Orlando, right? Spin it forward to today. That's where they were from Rob Hennigan's rebuild. Rob Hennigan tried to get this team to be, you know, just like where Philly is and Boston is. Obviously, Boston fell down a little bit, but I mean, I'm sure everyone realizes that they're right back in this tier if they're a couple moves away. They've got Tatum and Brown. They did the tank. They got the guys. But Orlando, they tanked, they tried, and they were just an 8 seed, a 7 seed for year after year after year. And what did they do this year? Even with the lottery reform, even with the play-in tournament, they traded Vucevic, Aaron Gordon, and Evan Fournier. They bottomed out. Now they got two top 10 picks in what's considered to be a loaded draft, and they got some cap space to play, and they're going to try to get back into the postseason. So I think tanking will be alive and well as long as your draft positioning is dependent on your record, and as long as there's a shot at getting that number one pick or even getting a top five pick in a class that's supposed to have a bunch of guys who are supposed to change your franchise, I think tanking will always exist.
You bring up ramifications in terms of Hinkie, which I think is also something that could be touched upon, because Brian and I on this podcast usually bring up the Hinkie special when we're doing like our off-season analysis. But your book really opened my eyes just to, you know, to the degree that agents in the Players Association is against that type of contract. Like, I knew it wasn't well received, but I really had no idea it was that overwhelmingly disliked. So that absolutely changes, like, my approach moving forward as well, just in terms of team building, because those contracts simply seem to be, well, not all that attractive at all for agents. They will do everything in their power to tell players, don't sign this. This is a horrendous deal unless you get more money up front. So, like, how did that come about, just going into that? Because you spend quite a significant period of time in the book talking about the Hinkie special. What did you learn from all that?
Yeah, it definitely originated back in Houston. And I think that the Chandler Parsons situation was one that I highlighted in the book. And I think he really was one of the earlier case studies where, you know, on one view, you look at it and say, you know, I'm giving an opportunity to make the NBA to someone who might not be getting it elsewhere. And, you know, for someone like TJ McConnell or at the time Robert Covington, who they just weren't getting opportunities to make the NBA, or Chandler Parsons, who was a second round pick, you know, someone who is just to get a guarantee, it's a non-guaranteed contract, but it's a guaranteed opportunity to make that money, right? And I think from there, you know, it's unfortunate where most of those guys are getting that deal with the hope on the team side that they will outplay that contract, right? So when you get a Jeremy Grant, you know, he was kind of pissed. I think I have him on the record in the book saying it's an awful contract because it limits your ability long term and what you can really make. But, you know, we're seeing teams still kind of do things along those lines where, you know, the Bucks, they traded to get Sam Merrill and Jordan Nwora last year in the draft to sign them to non-guaranteed deals to keep cap flexibility for that team. I mean, you got to flush out a roster somehow, and they definitely did that from all accounts from my reporting to clear up, you know, as much flexibility as they can. So I think one thing that Sam gets a lot of flack for is the turnover, giving guys, you know, low ball offers. But he did give a lot of players opportunities to make the NBA that wouldn't necessarily had it. And I think, you know, Tim Frazier is a great example where he's still kicking around the league. You know, he was the MVP of the D-League at the time. And, you know, the best deal he could do was get a 10-day contract with Philly. He gets to start. I mean, that was another thing that Sam also used in that time period. He used playing time as a carrot to get players to come to that team. Like, so many people get a 10-day contract, and they just sit on the bench for three games, and then they leave. So it's just it's a complicated factor. But at the end of the day, the goal of every agent and the goal of the players' union is to maximize every single player's earning opportunity. So on that face, hell yeah, the four-year Hinkie special is an awful contract for those guys. And, you know, it's certainly been dissuaded. But like we just said with Jordan Nwora and Sam Merrill, there's always going to be players willing to take it. So it's kind of just like the tanking question you asked me before. As long as, you know, people are willing to take advantage of what these rules allow, I think it's still going to happen.
Yeah, and we saw it with Lou Dort in OKC as well, which is immediately just one of the, like, best contracts of the league for OKC and worst contracts of the league for Lou Dort, because he could be earning, like, if that guy was a free agent right now, he'd be in line for probably a full mid-level exception, if not more. And now he's on a minimum contract for the next, I think, two more years still.
Yeah, yeah. And he's about to potentially get traded, you know, because he's now an amazing trade asset for the Thunder. So that's kind of how this whole cycle and wheel keeps on spinning, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I remember Deadspin at the time was, you know, hated just everything that Sam Hinkie was doing and called Robert Covington a patsy or something like that. But if you think back, you know, not only, you know, Covington, McConnell, but, you know, Jeremy Grant, I know you brought up KJ McDaniels in the book, who still breaks my heart that he's not in the NBA, because I was just so sure that guy was going to... Yeah. It's like, no way someone with those defensive tools aren't going to hit, and the offense just never came around, I guess. But even like a guy like Ish Smith is now, you know, making $5 or $6 million a year and still with the Wizards this year. You know, Christian Wood, Rashawn Holmes. So, like, if you... I just hate the the process was only about tanking for high draft picks. because Hinkie found a lot of quality NBA players who have since developed. I mean, Jeremy Grant gets a $60 million deal this past summer. Christian Wood gets $42 million. Rashawn Holmes is probably in line for, you know, at least eight figures this summer. Nerlens Noel, even. Like, yeah, I know he's a high draft pick, but he kind of bounced around, and now he's in line for a big raise as well. Like, he found a lot of guys who, just because they didn't necessarily stick in Philly, doesn't mean they weren't, like, NBA players. And he gave those guys opportunities to get their feet in the ground. I think it's a great point. Like, you could use that playing time just to get tape on, you know, get film that you can show to other GMs. Your agent can show to other GMs. It's like, hey, my guy could actually play in the NBA. Bring me in. Bring me into a better situation. Maybe he will shine, and then we can take that next step.
Yeah. The G League bubble, even this year, was an opportunity for guys to just get tape, to be able to stick around and keep showing the teams, look, I'm doing this. I'm still around. You know, give me a shot. I think that's another aspect of this league that gets overlooked. Like, the guys on the doorstep, they're looking for a shot. I mean, they're just looking for anywhere to play to make significant money. Same with, you know, video coordinator type guys, assistant coaches in the G League. Like, the people on the doorstep of the league are doing whatever they can every day to make it. And I think if teams want to take advantage of that for their benefit, you know, it's also benefiting those people too.
So I want to pivot now to go into some of your recent work at Bleacher Report, because you've been doing a lot of great stuff.
Thank you, man.
You know, all year, but especially lately, you've had some really good looks kind of at free agency. But also, I want to start with New Orleans, because we were talking earlier about competing interests in particular. And it feels like, given all of the stuff that has trickled out over the past few months with New Orleans, between Zion's reported unhappiness, Stan Van Gundy getting fired after the year, and that, you know, after 1 year, and then going, I think it was on like Dan Patrick, where he said, like, basically David Griffin and I were just not on the same page at all. So your column goes into what kind of went into the hiring of Willie Green, their new head coach. But I want to first ask about David Griffin, because it seems like, based on your reporting, he is very hands-on. It potentially cost them Jacques Vaughn in the interview process. But, you know, he has preferred involvement in minutes, rotations, skill development. He has an idea of who he wants in the starting lineup. In your experience around the league, is Griffin more involved than a typical GM president, or is this just kind of the new age of, you know, all of these guys want this much say over what their coaches are doing?
I think it's common around the league now. Like, Nate Bjorkgren's situation in Indiana, he did not hire a single assistant coach of his, from what I was told. And, you know, Orlando is clearly, the front office is having a big say in the staff that they're going to hire for Jamal Mosley, which I wrote in the article too. I mean, it varies team to team. Like, Nate McMillan comes into Atlanta and he saves that franchise pretty much, right? And now he's exerting a lot of power and a lot of influence. Tom Thibodeau, same thing in New York. It kind of varies team to team. I mean, the Lakers, you know, people want to joke about it, but yeah, LeBron's got a lot of say on what happens there. So in New Orleans, David Griffin definitely seems to be someone who's acting, you know, atop that organization, where it is his organization. He is the number one ranking official on the basketball operations. And for him, you know, he clearly sees that the best way to operate is to exert this influence on, you know, pretty much the majority of the decisions there. I've talked to coaches who worked on Alvin Gentry's staff, who worked on Stan Van Gundy's staff, who, you know, there's talk of him even coming in at halftime during games and saying, you know, let's do this in the second half. But, you know, that's involved. That, again, that happens across the league. So I don't want to single him out as someone who's done that. And I tried not to in the article, but clearly that's something that certain people don't want to work with, and Jacques Vaughn being one of them, and Stan Van Gundy being another. And, you know, it just goes to show that there's different ways to skin this cat. And, you know, those interpersonal dynamics we're talking about all throughout the book, you know, they're still happening today, and this is clearly one of them.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that Griffin envisioned a starting backcourt of Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Kyra Lewis Jr., which I found interesting because Lonzo Ball happens to be a free agent this summer, and he's one of the more notable ones.
Yes.
Does that mean Lonzo is probably on his way out of New Orleans, or does Griffin envision... I could see a world wherein like those two guys plus Lonzo, Ingram, and Zion could be like just a really fun small ball unit. But
yeah.
I don't know if you allocate that many resources to the backcourt if you have these two guys who you believe in that much.
Yeah, there's two sides to this. There's one where there's a word out there that the Pelicans view Lonzo as more of a playmaking wing than a guard, but I don't think Lonzo's going back to New Orleans. It just doesn't, everything you hear, it doesn't sound like that's going to happen, which is, I agree. I think he'd be the perfect fit next to those guys. I think someone who can get out and transition and also in the half court just spots up in the corner is someone that Philly would love to have, right? Like, that'd be a perfect pairing for Ben Simmons. I think there'd be value to keeping him with Zion or Brandon Ingram. But at this point in time, it doesn't seem like he's in the long-term plans for the Pelicans.
Get excited, Mort. Lonzo to the Bulls. It's possible.
Well, I mean, the Knicks, too. The Knicks, are looking for a point guard, and they have, what, 50-plus million in cap space? I mean, if there's a team out there that could go in and make some noise, it's the Knicks. And Jake, you just pointed it out, basically, also with Tom Thibodeau getting say over the coaching hires and, like, the coaching methods, like, that also means you get more power in virtually every decision.
I think so.
So that's one of those situations that we have to look for, and given that Lonzo does play defense, Tibbs is probably already on the phone.
Yeah, I think the Knicks are a serious factor there. I think the Bulls are a serious factor there. There's a lot of talk about the Lakers having interest there, but I talked to a UK Lakers podcast before I came on here. I think Lakers fans and Lakers brass also altogether need to kind of temper their expectations as to how much wiggle room they have to improve this roster outside of biannual mid-level type guys. Like, they're pretty hard, hamstrung here. And this goes back to the super team, the superstar asset collection type conversation we're having. Like, when you do go big game hunting and try to bring multiple stars together, you better do it in an organic way that allows you to have flexibility. Because if you just stand the torpedoes, to use a David Griffin expression, and limit yourself for your flexibility in the future when these unforeseen variables pop up, when injuries happen, when your stars don't love to play together or whatever, it limits yourself in the future. So this is all kind of part of the same conversation we've been having.
Yeah,
well, I mean, Chris Paul is going to the Lakers on a mid-level anyway, according to Lakers fans. So
Chris Paul, Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan.
They're all going to sign min deals or exception deals, of course, because right now.
Jake, also included in your report was something. So the Pelicans general manager and Brandon Ingram were at Phoenix's Game 5 against the Clippers in the Western Conference Finals. Zion Williamson was also supposed to go on that trip along with one of New Orleans' assistant coaches, but neither one actually went. So given what we've heard about Zion and just his general feelings toward the franchise this offseason, that he may be unhappy or that members of his family are already like eyeing an exit, did you get any sense of why he canceled that trip, or just what the overall like organizational feeling is about Zion right now?
If I knew exactly why, I would have written it. Would have written it. But all this talk that he's had a lot of obligations this year, whether it be going to Oregon to go to Nike stuff or LA for media stuff or whatever. He's been a busy guy. He's had a busy offseason. And by all accounts, he hasn't loved how busy he is. I think being this global superstar is something that it takes a lot of people a lot of time to figure out how to manage it and be happy. I think that's like, remember the last season, that was kind of a big talking point, right? Like, why are NBA players so unhappy? I think that's, I'm not saying Zion is unhappy. I'm just saying that I think all of the responsibilities that come into play with building a brand and all that type of stuff, it takes a toll. So that's kind of the only real educated guess I've got as to why he might not have wanted to go. May not have lined up with the schedule, but yeah, at the end of the day, would the Pelicans have loved to have had Zion and Brandon spend some time together in a playoff environment? For sure. So I did think it was noteworthy that he was originally intended to go and he canceled, and that's why I put it in the piece.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't sure if there was anything, you know, more behind that than what you could confirm. But so, I mean, this sets up a very interesting offseason for New Orleans, because you just, you know, you let go of Stan Van Gundy after a year. You're bringing in Willie Green. It seems like there is mounting pressure to win now, but you also have this Lonzo thing to balance. So how do you see things playing out for New Orleans over the next few weeks? And then heading into the season, how do you think Willie Green's going to fare in this environment?
Yeah, their first task, I think, at number 10, it seems pretty clear that they're looking to trade out this pick. From teams I've talked to, it seems like they're actually starting to look at number 10 as an opportunity to get off of Steven Adams or Eric Bledsoe rather than use that pick to just straight up get a veteran that can help them in their quest to make the postseason. Because, you know, you canvass the league right now, there just aren't that many difference maker players available. Like, there's a lot of talk, I'm going to write this on Monday, that a lot of people are available in Utah, a lot of those wings, but you know, at what cost? Like, I just think that you know, it's a lot more easier said than done. They're like, oh, we're just going to trade number 10 for whatever. So I think that's their first task. You know, what can they do with that number 10 pick to either optimize their roster this year or to create more flexibility to continue optimizing it? Free agency, like we talked about, I don't think Lonzo's coming back. I think from there, it's about trying to find these complementary pieces to round out the edges. I mean, do things like Morton's Bulls did with Garrett Temple and Thaddeus Young, like veterans who are proven winners but don't necessarily have like a giant market, like maybe even what Philly did back in the day with trying to bring on J.J. Redick and Gerald Henderson and that stuff that, you know, Griff has done in the past. I think they're clearly trying to make the playoffs while, as I wrote in the story, like thread this needle of compete for the postseason but also grow these young guys, because I think there's clear emphasis from Griff that, like, I drafted these dudes, and, like, I think they're good. I think they're great, even. Like, get them there. So that's going to be the task that Willie has. And clearly he's been, you know, a critical factor in Phoenix and their coaching staff and helping them get to the next level. He also was a valued member in Golden State. So, you know, now the test is on, though, right? Like, can he do it? And they're going to, you know, There's still a lot of coaches and staff people left to hire and fill out the rest of his staff. So I think depending on who they bring on there will also tell a little bit as to what type of players they're trying to develop. Right, if they bring on like a noted big man development coach, you know, maybe that's someone to work on Jackson Hayes and maybe help Zion down in the post. But I think overall that's kind of where they're at here. They're trying to develop these young guys while also compete for the postseason, knowing that the clock is ticking with Zion.
Yeah, that's interesting. It kind of reminds me of something you wrote in the book, especially about Orlando with like Ben Gordon, Channing Frye, and even Philly in that 2015-16 season with Elton Brand, where, you know, you have to bring in those older veterans just to like set an example, like just teach these guys how to go about your day to day in the NBA. I forget exactly how you phrased it, but like, especially for someone like Zion, where you're coming in with all this new money and new fame, just how to balance all of these things and also like still continue to work on your basketball game, because that's how you're going to continue rising the ladder. You know, it's been probably nice for a guy like Giannis, in comparison, who could kind of develop behind the scenes for those first couple of years and like not have such a glaring spotlight on him, and then by the time he got to, you know, start to be like, oh crap, this guy's really good, he'd already built a solid foundation. So yeah, it's interesting to hear that they're looking for that type of player, and especially interesting that they're trying to, you know, dump Bledsoe. Bledsoe's no surprise, I feel like, because they just got him as part of the Drew trade. But Steven Adams, they traded actual assets to get him last year.
And gave him an immediate contract extension.
Yeah, so that's not a great look. So that's my final question about New Orleans is, do you think David Griffin's starting to feel a little bit of You know, is his heat warming up? Like, is he under pressure to make these win now moves because he knows if I miss the playoffs another year, I'm probably out of here?
Of course. That's all I'll say. Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. You know, when you fire your head coach after 1 year, and you are very involved in the next decision and are already previewing the level of influence you want to have, I think that just signals, you know, trying to pull strings to keep yourself employed. Yeah.
Yeah. So the other piece I want to ask you about that you also wrote for BR, you spoke with some NBA executives around the league, and they were saying, you know, given the state of this free agent class and kind of where a lot of teams are cap-wise, that the big thing we might expect is just a lot more sign-in trades. And we've started to see that really over the last couple of years where, you know, you're getting more high-profile guys involved in these types of deals, like Kevin Durant with the, you know, the D'Angelo Russell KD deal, Jimmy Butler a couple years ago, Gordon Hayward, as you mentioned in the article, turned into a sign and trade so that Boston could get that massive trade exception. And, you know, so many of these teams are not only over the cap, but, like, you know, the Bucks and the Nets and the Sixers are probably going to be well into tax territory, which also complicates things. So who are some of the notable names that you think could be in that sign and trade mix this summer?
I mean, obviously Dennis Schroeder is being floated left and right, but, you know, like I wrote in the article, sign and trade is great, but it only really works out when all three parties are interested. So it's not so simple as the Lakers are just going to sign and trade Dennis Schroeder to anywhere they want him to go. There's got to be a team that wants to bring him on there. I think the Kyle Lowry situation is really interesting, where a lot of the teams that want him pretty much outside of Miami, like New Orleans, for example, they're throwing their name in that hat. I think that's also just kind of a signaling of their attempts to get better. I don't think Kyle Lowry really has a shot at going to New Orleans whatsoever. I mean, I don't think New Orleans has a shot at landing Kyle Lowry, let's say. But for him to get to Philly, you know, he's got to be signed and trade there. Same with both Los Angeles teams. You know, even with Danny Green potentially leaving Philadelphia, like, that's an opportunity for maybe the Sixers to recruit some asset back. Spencer Dinwiddie, Kelly Oubre, like, a lot of these teams now, just like we've been talking about, this big game hunting world we're living in, like, teams are trying to be as creative as possible to manipulate the cap, manipulate the CBA to get better. And the sign and trade is just the latest iteration of that. And I think it's particularly coming to play this summer, being that all these teams at the top, you know, Milwaukee, the LA teams, Brooklyn, Philly, you know, they're just, I mean, even Golden State to a certain degree, depending on what they do. I mean, Portland to a certain degree. Like, all these teams in the mix here, they just don't have much flexibility. And a sign and trade is a clear path for them to get better.
Yeah. I find it interesting that Oubre and Dinwiddie are coming up as potential targets in particular, because both of those teams are just so far over the tax already.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not to say that whatever Dinwiddie and Oubre sign for, they're going to get the exact same amount of salary back, but that's going to cause their tax bill to swell regardless. But at the same time, I mean, those are, you know, pieces that you don't want to lose for nothing. So I'll be interested to see how these teams that are just so far over tax territory and, like, already looking at tax bills, you know, 50, 60, even more for the Warriors, how do they manage, or how do they balance, you know, we're trying not to pay $400 million for our roster next year, but yeah. Also both teams are, you know, you have Steph in his prime still. Nets, obviously, were like a half shoe size away from possibly going to the finals this year. You know, it's a tricky balance for all these teams, I feel like.
Yeah, and that's, you know, exactly why I think tanking and team building and all this stuff is such a hot button topic too, being that, like, the goal is to win the title, right? But luck is so much of a factor. I would love to be able to quantify it, but you obviously can't. But I think it plays so much bigger, like, in the conversation throughout these playoffs about injuries and asterisks and all that type of stuff happens every single year. And so team building and these maneuverings on the edges here, you know, they're so important, because what you're trying to do to win a title, you're trying to control as much as you can control, right? And this is the only thing these teams really have to do so. They're trying to just assemble a roster with the most talent and the most complementary talent possible. And that's why, you know, the moves are on the margins are more shrewd than ever, because the competition is more shrewd than ever too.
Yeah. So I have to ask before you go, because you're a Philly guy, have you heard much on the Ben Simmons front? What's your impression of that situation as we head into the draft, head into free agency?
Yeah, I'm going to write about this on Monday as well. But nice. I think the market is not what Philly would love it to be right now. I think that's just what it is. And it seems like something that, you know, the draft was being used as an opportunity to kind of streamline these conversations. And, oh, there's picks involved here, like blah, 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 blah. We need to be at a prep. But I think at this point, there's no rush. There's no pressure to move him. I'm sure I'm saving some details for the article, but, you know, I'm sure Philly would prefer to have him not be there. But at this point in time, you know, they don't need to, and he could be traded before the deadline. You know, Daryl's the biggest proponent of, you know, the roster you bring at the training camp is definitely not going to be the roster you finish the year with. So they're clearly looking, and I see it definitely feels like a priority for them, but I don't see it happening in the next week or so.
Interesting. Yeah. See, you just broke Brian's heart.
That's what I've been saying for weeks now.
It might happen in August, but it's not happening now.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I've been one of the only people on Sixers Twitter who's like, hey guys, we don't need to do it right now. Like, maybe, you know, especially with what's happening in Portland with Dame, and, you know, do you pull the trigger on this the CJ and Ben deal, knowing it could help Portland make Dame more likely to stay? Or do you wait this out, see what Portland does this summer? Because if Portland can't retool their roster, you know, Jason Quick of The Athletic had an article yesterday, like, what they're going to do. And we'll see what happens with Norman Powell this summer. Like, if Norman Powell gets an absurd offer somewhere else, he leaves them. They don't do a sign-and-trade, so he leaves them empty-handed. They've just lost that with no talent in return. Like, does Dame, you know, start to get... He hasn't requested the trade yet, but, like, who's to say he won't in a month or two? And then, you know, Bradley Beal's the same way. Like, I just can't... I know the Wizards this whole time have been saying, we're not trading Bradley Beal, we're not trading Bradley Beal. But I just can't help but wonder if Beal sees what's happening with Dame in Portland, starts to rethink his future in Washington, and if Washington also sees, oh, crap, Damian Lillard might be on the market soon, maybe we need to move first with Beal, because some team, you know, if someone acquires Damian Lillard, that is one monster, monster trade package that won't be available to us. And, you know, there are enough teams can put together enticing offers that it's not like they're going to have to trade Bradley Beal for like 2 second round picks. They'll still get something for him. But if you have a certain trade package in mind or a certain team that you would hope to engage with, you have to now, if you're Washington, you have to also see, like, oh, Dame might happen. Or, you know, again, Chicago and Zach LaVine, there hasn't been any concrete rumor that he's leaving, but he's also a free agent in 2022. So, that's kind of what I'm trying to keep an eye on heading into the draft and free agency, is, like, how teams balance this, we need to make a move now, versus there are a couple guys who it might behoove us to wait it out a little bit for.
Agreed. I think you're on to something, but yeah, I don't want to spoil too much for what I'm writing, but I agree. I think there is value in patience in this particular situation. You know, we saw Daryl's predecessor, two predecessors before him, and his old buddies, Sam Inkey, kind of wait a little bit too long certain times with, like, Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens. But in this situation, yeah, I think there's benefit to waiting and seeing how the market evolves.
Yeah. As you said, I mean, Ben signed for 4 more years, so it's not like, you know, this guy's not becoming a free agent next summer. It's not like he can walk for nothing. Same with Dame. So Portland also, you know, Portland is not under the same amount of pressure with Dame as Washington might be with Beal, Chicago might be with LaVine, if neither of those guys agree to an extension before then. So it's going to be a really interesting summer. It's the NBA, and I would say in July, but the NBA in August, it's always wild.
For sure.
More, do you have any final questions for Jake before we let him get out of here?
Not really a question. I just want to you know, compliment you on the book, Jake.
Thank you.
It was very well done. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it's you actually brought it up a couple of minutes ago, just also that you need luck as well. And there's this whole thing that you look at it from a very analytical perspective, but there's just also these components that are entirely unquantifiable, where I almost like compare it to the actual on-court product as well. Like, we can always go into certain games and we can go, well, if we put this guy here and that guy there, all right, strategically that makes sense. But if you come down in a, you know, 3 overtime game and everyone is gassed, you know what? Then analytics don't matter at all. It comes down to just crazy ass shot making and execution.
For sure.
Or you can throw every ounce of logic out of the window. And I think team building, as you kind of allude to, is sort of the same thing. Like, you can approach it from a certain logical perspective, analytical perspective. But at the end of the day, if you're going to make yourself an NBA championship winner or contender, you will need luck. You will need something that is unquantifiable to happen for you to reach that level. I think that is such an interesting component to it.
For sure, yeah. Thank you guys again for all the kind words and the feedback and the platform to talk about it. You know, anyone listening, you know, it's available on Amazon, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, Triumph Books, my publisher. Please rate and review if you do buy it. That goes a long way. And yeah, there's so much info in there that you won't find anywhere else that I know you guys, you know, that's what made you guys like it, so I think your listeners will like it too. And I'm at Bleacher Report every week, so I'm bringing news and rumors, you know, as much as I can, and just trying to cover this league and provide some more truth through all the bullshit that comes out. So
it sounds like we'll have some potential Ben Simmons reporting on Monday. So check Jake out on Twitter at Jake L. Fisher, FISCHER. Please follow him on Twitter. Buy the book. It's great. And I think you're the first person that I think confirmed the details of the Justice Winslow, Danny Ainge would be trade. Like, I know it had always been reported he offered 4 first-round picks, but I don't think I had ever seen the details of the picks that he had offered before. And I'm still so salty that they didn't take him up on that offer, because one of them was the pick that became Jaylen Brown. So,
yeah.
For more Danny Ainge slander, please buy Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. No, Ainge is featured, but no, not as much slander. Jake, thank you again, and everyone, thank you for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and by our special guest, Bleacher Report's Jake Fisher, the author of Built to Lose. Have a good weekend, guys.
You too, man.